Hi, and welcome back to History's Ink Podcast. I'm Mallory Nye, and this is episode 14. Thanks for listening. In this episode today, I'll be doing something a little bit different to previous episodes. That is, I'm going to be reading the short tract that I discussed in the previous episode, episode 13. The one that was written by King James VI of Scotland and the First of England, his counterblast to tobacco, which, if you haven't listened to it already, in episode 13 I discuss some of the background issues from that. Now, King James, or King James I as he's most often known, because at the time that he wrote this book, England was a much more powerful nation than Scotland. The book itself was written in 1604, just about a year after he became the English king, although he'd ruled Scotland for much of his life in some way or other. As I said, I'm going to be reading the book itself in this episode. If you want to know more, then do have a listen to the previous episode about the book, about King James, and why he decided to write such a counterblast to the newly developed habit of smoking tobacco. That's all on episode 13 of this same History's Ink podcast. That's a background episode to this material here today. Now, as you'd expect, the original of King James's book was written in the English language of its time, which is considerably different in style and spelling to how the language is used today. What you're going to be hearing in this episode is an edited version of the book, written and of course read out in the style that is intended to make it more accessible to a contemporary audience. For the sake of making this manageable, I have edited out parts of the book, so this episode isn't too long. This is not because they're not interesting. The whole short book is worth a read. But I wanted to fit this podcast episode into something that fitted with the other episodes, that wasn't too long, and so kept your interest and attention. If you'd like to read the whole thing, then it is available. See the show notes for this episode on the History's Ink website. That's histories, with a YS, histories-ink.com. I'll repeat that web address at the end, so you don't have to remember it quite yet. And of course, again, a shout out to the University of Glasgow, particularly the School of Critical Studies, for use of their recording studio for this episode. It makes a great difference. Thanks very much. So, this is it. King James's Counterblast to Tobacco, written in 1604. Preface to the reader. My dear compatriots, every human body, no matter how healthy it may be, is subject, or at least naturally inclined, to many types of illnesses, diseases, or infirmities. The same is the case that every commonwealth or state has its discontents and natural corruption, no matter how well it is governed, or how peaceful it may be. Therefore, it is no wonder that although our country and Commonwealth of England is peaceful and wealthy, and has been so for a long time, it is also subject to its own natural infirmities. We, of all nations, are a people who most lovingly and reverently obey our ruler. And yet we, as time has often borne witness, are too easily seduced to make rebellion, often on very slight grounds. Our fortunate and often proved valour in wars abroad, and our hearty and reverent obedience to our rulers at home, have given us a long and thrice happy peace. Our peace has given us wealth, and peace and wealth have produced a general sluggishness, which makes us wallow in all sorts of idle delights and soft delicacies. These are the first seeds of the subversion of all great monarchies. Our clergy have become negligent and lazy, and our nobility and gentry are prodigal and are addicted to their private delights. Our lawyers are covetous, and our common people are prodigal and seeking sensationalism. In general, most people care more for their own private needs than for their mother country, the Commonwealth. The remedy for this is for the king, as the proper physician of his state, to purge it of all these diseases with the best medicines for these ailments. This is done through a mild and yet just form of government, to maintain a well-behaved populace and prevent all occasions of commutation. The king should make an example of his own person and court to ensure that we are all ashamed of our sluggish weaknesses and that we are energized to follow a life of honest exercise and are fit for battle. he should also make sure that both he and his court are modestly presented and dressed, to make us ashamed of our prodigalities. He should be prepared to give lively admonitions and careful oversight of the clergy, to wake them up again so that they are more diligent in their offices. He should reform the corruptions of partial, covetous, and bribing lawyers through efficient trials and appropriately severe and exemplary punishments as necessary. The king should act generally through the example of his own person, so that by the due execution of good laws he should reform and abolish piece by piece these old and immoral abuses. Of course, Rome was not built in a single day. To heal his state of these diseases, the king must work hard to achieve a proper and effective treatment. Some of these maladies are so base and contemptible that one may say that they are too low for the law to look on, and too mean for a king to exert his authority, or even to bend his eye upon. But they are corruptions, as much as the greatest of them. Thus an ant is an animal as much as an elephant is. Likewise a wren is a bird as much as a swan. And a small case of toothache is a disease as much as is the dreaded plague. But for these base sorts of corruption within the Commonwealth, not only the king or any inferior magistrate, but anybody at all may serve to be a physician, by discovering and impugning the error, and in doing so thus persuading reformation. And surely, in my opinion, there cannot be a more base and yet more harmful corruption in a country than our widespread vile use, and thus abuse, of taking tobacco. This has moved me to the extent of discovering and explaining the abuses thereof in this following short pamphlet. If any reader may consider this a light argument, so it is but a toy that is bestowed upon it. And since the subject is merely smoke, I think the fume of an idle brain may serve for a sufficient battery against so fumous and feeble an enemy. If my grounds for argument are found to be true, then that is all I look for. But if they carry with them the force of persuasion, then that is all I can wish for, and more than I can expect. My only care is that you, my dear compatriot, may learn from even this smallest trifle of the sincerity of my meaning in greater matters. My aim here is to never spare any pain, and in doing so, to tend to the procurement of your health and prosperity. That is the end of the preface, and so now we begin the body of the book. The first part, the introduction. The manifold abuses of this vile habit of taking tobacco can best be understood if initially we give some consideration to both the origins of the custom and likewise to the causes and circumstances of its first entry into this country. It is certainly the case that these customs emerged from a godly, necessary, and honourable ground. They were first brought to us by the efforts of worthy, virtuous, and distinguished people, who are themselves quite justly held in great and reverent esteem by all wise, virtuous, and temperate spirits. Even so, in contrast to this, the habits themselves are disgraceful, since the original forms of these customs are base corruption and barbarity. Their successful introduction into our country was due to the unconsidered and childish affectation of novelty, as was indeed the first invention of tobacco taking. For tobacco is a common herb, which grows almost everywhere under diverse names. It was some of the barbarous Indians who first discovered its properties, that it is a preservative, and it is also an antidote for the pox, a filthy disease from which many of these barbarous people are prone to suffer, as all men know, due to the unhygienic and melancholic constitution of their bodies, and due to the intemperate heat of their climate. It was thus from them that that most detestable disease was first brought into Christendom, and so likewise from them was also brought this use of tobacco, as a stinking and unsavoury antidote for this malady, which is so corrupt and execrable. Their use of burning tobacco as a form of fumigation against that disease was itself a cancer or venom that had the power to destroy. And now, good friends, let us, I pray, consider this. What honour or policy can move us to imitate the barbarous and beastly manners of the wild, godless, and slavish Indians, especially in such a vile and stinking custom. It is well known that we disdain to imitate even the manners of our neighbours the French, who have the distinction of being the first Christian kingdom, and we cannot endure the spirit of the Spaniards, whose king now rules over such vast dominions that he is comparable with the Emperor of Turkey. Shall we, I say, that have been so long civil and wealthy in peace, famous and invincible in war, and so fortunate in both, we that have always been able to aid any of our neighbours, although we never deafened their ears with any of our own supplications for assistance, shall we, I say without blushing, abase ourselves so much as to imitate these beastly Indians, who are slaves to the Spaniards, who refuse the world, and are as yet aliens from the holy covenant of God? Why do we not also imitate them in other ways, such as in walking around naked as they do, in preferring glasses, feathers, and such toys to gold and precious stones as they do? Yea, why don't we not just deny God, and indeed worship the devil as they do? As for the corrupt basis of the first use of this tobacco, we would do very well to agree on the foolish and groundless first entry of it into this kingdom. It is not so long since this abuse first arrived among us here from the New World, even though this present age cannot remember so well who brought it and how it was first introduced among us. It was neither brought in by a king, a great conqueror, or by a learned physician. It was, together with the report of a great discovery for our conquest, that some 2 or 3 savage Indians were brought over here together with this savage custom. But the pity is that the poor, wild, barbarous men died, but their vile, barbarous custom has remained alive. Indeed, it has remained in fresh vigour. It does seem quite a miracle to me that such a custom has sprung from so vile a ground, and it has been brought in by a father, that is, Sir Walter Raleigh, who is so generally hated, and yet it has been welcomed on such a slender warrant. For if those who first put it into practice here had remembered how it was used by them back where it had come from, I am sure they would have been loath to have taken as far as they did the imputation of that disease upon them, by using it as the cure. For sanus non est opus medico, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, and we would never use an antidote or counterpoison if there had been no poison taken before. But it is the case that diverse customs have entered and have been established here in our commonwealth for no good reason, and that their use may hereafter prove to be both necessary and profitable. So therefore we should examine whether there is a clear connection and resonance between the base ground and foolish innovation of this stinking antidote and its loathsome and dangerous use. At this point, I've edited out several pages of discussion by King James of the arguments for and against the health properties or the supposed health properties of tobacco. And again, I refer you to the actual context of the book itself. It's very much within the understanding of science, medical science at that time, which James had a pretty proficient grasp of the particular arguments for and against health. And they're explored in the book, but I've edited them out, as I said earlier, for the sake of conciseness of this particular reading of his book. And I move on to a more sort of concluding passage now, where he brings his main arguments, more sort of social and political as well as personal arguments, against the use of tobacco smoking. I go back again to the words of King James. Thus having, I trust, sufficiently answered the principal arguments that I used in defence of this vile habit, it remains only to inform you of the sins and vanities that you commit when making such a filthy abuse. First, are you not guilty of sinful and shameful lust? For lust can be manifest in any of the senses as much as in the feelings. And although you may be in perfect health and untroubled by disease, can you even be merry in the tavern or lascivious in the brothel, if you are without any tobacco to whet your appetite for any of these sorts of recreation? Indeed, you cannot help lusting after it, as the children of Israel lusted for quails in the wilderness. Second, the use, or rather abuse, of tobacco is a branch of the sin of drunkenness, which is the root of all sins. For, as the only delight that drunkards take in wine, is the strength of the taste and the force of the fume that they inhale into their brains. For no drunkards love any weak or sweet drinks. The same is true with tobacco. Are not the strong heat and the fumes the only qualities that make tobacco so delectable to all the lovers of it? And no one likes a strong, heady drink on their first day, because no one becomes wicked straight away. It is by habit and practice that they become alert to the taste, piece by piece. In the end, a drunkard will have as great a thirst to be drunk as a sober man to quench his thirst with water when he needs it. So, is this not the very same for all who are hooked on tobacco, which they do themselves attribute to a bewitching quality of the substance? Third, and is this not the greatest sin of all, that you, the people of this kingdom, who are created and ordained by God to bestow both your persons and goods for the maintenance of both the honour and safety of your king and country, should render yourself on both accounts? In your persons, you have by this continual vile custom brought yourself to this shameful imbecility, that you are not able to ride or walk even a short distance without having a glowing coal brought to you from the nearest poorhouse to light your tobacco with. A man cannot be thought able for any service in the army for war, if he cannot frequently endure the lack of meat, drink, and sleep, much more than he must endure the lack of tobacco. In the times of the many glorious and victorious battles fought by this nation, there was no word of tobacco. But now, if we found ourselves in a time of war, and if you were to make some night raid, a cavalcado, on your enemies, and if any of you should take the leisure of staying behind his fellows to take some tobacco, for my part I would never be sorry if any evil chance might befall him. To form a habit for anything that cannot be easily ignored is most harmful to the people of any land. The soft, easy life was the wreck and ruin of first the Persian and then next the Roman empires. And this very habit of taking tobacco is even to this day accounted so effeminate among the Indians themselves, that in the market they will offer no price for the sale of a slave if they find he is a heavy tobacco smoker. Now, think of how this habit leaves you so short. Let the gentry of this land bear witness to this. Some of them are spending £300 to £400 each year on this precious stink, which I am sure might be spent on many far better uses. I have read indeed of a knavish courtier who abused the favour of his master, the Roman Emperor, Alexander Severus. He took bribes from various people to intercede in his master's ear, although he never once opened his mouth on their behalf, as he had promised. His doom was to be justly choked with smoke. Smoke he sold, and with smoke he will perish. But even with so many smoke buyers as are at present in this kingdom, I have never read nor heard of such a thing. And as for the vanities committed in pursuit of this filthy habit, it is both a great vanity and uncleanliness that at the table, which is a place of respect, cleanliness and modesty, that men are not ashamed to sit tossing their tobacco pipes and puffing their tobacco smoke at one another, making the filthy smoke and stink from it all around the dishes and infecting the air, when very often people that abhor this are trying to eat. Surely smoke is better in the kitchen than in the dining room. Even so, it often makes a kitchen within the inward parts of men, by soiling and infecting them with an unctuous and oily kind of soot, as had been found in some heavy tobacco takers when they were opened up after their deaths. And it is not only at meal times, but also no other time or action is exempted from the public use of this uncivil practice. It is as if the wives of Dieppe had entered into a contest of manners with this nation, in which their worst manners would in all reason be found to be no worse than ours on this point. The public use of tobacco at all times and in all places has now prevailed to such an extent that various people who are sound both in judgment and decency have been forced to take up the habit without any desire to do so. This is partly because they were ashamed to appear different, like the two philosophers who were forced to duck themselves in rainwater, and in doing so became fools along with the crowd. It is also in part to be like the person who decided to eat garlic, even though they did not like it, so that they might not be troubled with the smell of it on the breath of their fellows. And is it not a great vanity that a man cannot now heartily welcome his friend without them immediately going straight for the tobacco? No, it has taken the place of a cure, a point of good fellowship, and he that refuses to take a pipe of tobacco among his fellows, though by his own choice he would rather feel the smell of a sewer, is considered to be peevish and bad company, in the same way they do with tippling in the cold eastern countries. Yet the mistress cannot entertain her servant better than to give him a pipe of tobacco out of her own fair hand. But here it is not only a great vanity, but also a great contempt of God's good gifts, that the sweetness of man's breath, being a good gift of God, should be wilfully corrupted by this stinking smoke. And on this I must confess, it has too strong a nature. And so, that which is an ornament of nature, and can neither be faked or recovered again once it is lost, shall be filthily corrupted with an incurable stink, whose vile quality is as directly contrary to the false opinion that it has some wholesomeness, as the venom of putrefaction is contrary to a powerful medicine. Moreover, this is such a great iniquity, and against all humanity, that a husband should not be ashamed to reduce in this way his delicate, wholesome, and clean-complexioned wife to such an extremity, that she must also corrupt her sweet breath by taking tobacco, or else to resolve to live in a perpetual stinking torment. So have you not reason, then, to be ashamed, and give up this filthy novelty, so basely grounded, so foolishly received, and so grossly mistaken for something beneficial? In your abuse of tobacco, you are sinning against God, harming yourself both in your persons and your wealth, and by doing so also accumulating the characteristics and behaviour of vanity upon yourself. By indulging in this habit, you are making yourself a spectacle in the eyes of all foreign civil nations, and you earn the scorn and condemnation of all strangers that come among you. This is a habit that is loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, dangerous to the lungs. And in the black, stinking fumes that come from tobacco, its nearest resemblance is of the horrible Stygian smoke of the bottomless pit of hell. So, that's it. That's the end of King James's book. Thanks for listening today. As usual, if you want to find out more about this topic and the podcast series, then there are more details on the podcast website, which is, as I said before, histories-inc.com. histories-inc.com. And, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Histories Inc. website also contains a link for the full text version of this book, both in the original 17th century English and also in the edited contemporary version I have used today. You may also be interested to know about the other podcast I make, which is called Religion Bites, about the contemporary study of religion and culture. That can be found either through a link on the historiesinc.com website or otherwise on Religion Bites, that's all one word, religionbites.xyz. religionbites.xyz. It's rather different from this podcast, and I hope you'll give it a try. And of course, if you're listening to this on iTunes or Stitcher, don't forget to subscribe for free to the podcast to make sure you don't miss future episodes. And if you like the podcast, then do please leave a review. It helps other people to find this podcast. So, that's all for today. I'll see you again soon. Bye for now.